Blog Talk Radio.
To be everywhere
at the same in all of the circles as they were.
It was a curious act of good fortune. I was first given psilocybin, which is yet another drug which is similar to those first two, by Richard Alpert, who became Ram Dass. Because I was his undergraduate, kind of one of his favorite undergraduates, and I graduated and met him in Paris, and he said, the greatest thing in the world has happened to me, and I want to share it with you. That's a hard offer to turn down.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so I became friends and familiar with what was called the Harvard Group.
I see.
I came west and was doing graduate work at Stanford, and there was the West Coast Group in Menlo Park. And these were the two important groups in the country at that time who were working with people. There were lots of other groups working with animals and doing physiological research and so forth. But the people who were really the edgy people were west and east. And I was also friends, really, through the woman who became my wife, with the Ken Kesey group, which were the kind of wild outlaws of psychedelics. So I was fortunate in being in all the right places at all the right times.
Now, were you at all involved? I noticed I didn't see it in the in this book, but. I was curious as to were you involved at all in the with Tim Leary and whatnot when he was dealing with the with his experiments in mind control experiments?
Well,
the government.
Yeah, well, not really. Tim, I worked with Leary and Alpert, and I was in Mexico one summer with them, not the summer that became famous, but the summer that everyone thought was so sensible. And at that point, the question of mind control was really only, the only people interested in mind control actually was the intelligence agencies, and I think they're misnamed, but the not-so-intelligent agencies of the U.S. government, who were trying all kinds of drugs in all kinds of ways, doing some truly shockingly unethical experiments on people. And I was aware of that. We all were, but we really had not much to do with it. And the person who actually pushed Tim Leary out of Harvard, kind of made the biggest stink about Leary, was another professor who, it turned out later, actually was also paid by the CIA.
You had to wonder about that because there were so many mind control experiments going on in the 60s, 70s, and even up to today involving psychedelics. But I think the most, a few of the most famous ones were the ones where they spiked all of the they spiked the bakery with LSD in France. Were you familiar with that?
Yeah, that's
that.
That's an interesting story, and we're not sure about it. There's an overly long book called A Terrible Mistake, goes into that in detail. And
no, Hank is Hank Alberelli. I've had him on my show, and he's kind of a friend. And
he knows more about the things that I know least about.
Yeah.
And
they're all mind control
the
experiments.
The question of the bakery is one, but here's one that is an American. Which was the notion of having a mist of LSD kind of into the fog over San Francisco. And what they found out is that it didn't work.
Well, I know that they put it in the train stations, and I think it was the train stations in New York and the subways. They tried it there, and then they tried it in the... with a bunch of military guys, with Air Force guys actually, and it didn't turn out so good. However,
well, there's
it
a wonderful bit
there.
Of footage on YouTube that shows British soldiers having been given LSD and marched around, and then you see a few hours later, and one is in a tree, and one is lying down at the edge of a tree, and one is wandering off.
Yeah.
And what basically they found is that LSD has many uses. And that giving it to people for military purposes never turned out to be one of them. The CIA eventually just gave it up
They did give it up.
Went
yeah.
on to do, you know, work with other things.
I was also curious about the mushrooms that I mean. I have to admit, I mean, back in the 70s and so on, and we did so much experimentation with. I had so many good friends that were trying everything, but of the few things that I remember mushrooms. Have you done much? I know you talk about it in the book, but have you done much research on that? And
well,
some of the
again, we've used psilocybin, which is the important chemical in the mushrooms.
Right.
And the thing about the mushrooms is there's over 100 species that
right.
have psilocybin or psilocyne in them.
Right.
And they all have, again, very similar effects, which is they basically are a shorter acting version of LSD.
Mm. Okay. I was curious about the sacred mushroom. I forget the name of it exactly. It's from the Middle East. It's supposed to be the prophetic mushroom, you know, the sacred mushroom.
Well, there's
it's still available and it's sold actually on the internet.
Right.
But
well, there's
I'm very curious
a lot of
as
mushrooms
to
that have.
I don't know anybody who's taken it, but I read a number of books and people about people who have experimented with it.
Well, there's another
mushroom
called Amanita muscaria, which is
right.
the mushroom you see in all the Christmas scenes. Which is the little red mushroom with the white dots.
That's correct. Yep.
And
yep.
I've watched some footage of reindeer eating them up and getting stoned, and then you begin to wonder where did we get this mythology of reindeers who fly?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And it turns out that they don't actually fly; they just think they're flying.
Right. Right. Kind of like what people do. But,
exactly.
But in these experiments that you conducted,
mm-hmm.
I know that you mentioned that they originally started working with animals, but they didn't see any significant things, and that's when they put it away, and then later picked it up and used it at different higher doses and so on. But so it doesn't have that it has that effect on reindeer, this particular mushroom, but did LSD have that effect on animals?
Well, what they found in the original work when Hoffman synthesized it, as he was synthesizing lots and lots of compounds, and they
yeah.
fed it to some laboratory animals, and the laboratory animals basically lay around, and it's hard to read expressions on mice, but they were probably smiling. And
they
kind of said, well, they just lie around. It doesn't seem to be very useful.
They didn't do anything, yeah. Yeah, they
and
couldn't
so
verbalize.
When he rediscovered it and accidentally took some himself through a kind of an open cut in his finger,
right.
what he discovered is it's the most powerful chemical in terms of affecting human behavior that we've ever discovered. And the work on animals has became very uninteresting. Because this was
yeah.
clearly a drug that affected consciousness, and that's where all the action went.
Have you found that I have to bring this up because I think it's one of the more significant things that I recall of that period, the 60s and so on. There's certain people, that, like for instance, George Harrison admitted to doing over 2,000 acid trips, okay,
yeah.
As well as McCartney and John Lennon. And I was curious. Did you work with any of these guys while they administer any of these, or?
No, they were. I'd say the word administer is a very kind word. Let's say Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds,
right.
is exactly what the title says it is. It's a song about LSD,
right?
And that these guys were taking it at a much lower dose than most of the work I did. You know, there used to be something called in the 60s a museum dose. That's the same dose now, which is called a disco hit.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it's a low enough dose so that you can kind of function.
Yeah. I remember they used to sell mescaline was sold in capsules. You know, we used to buy them in capsules back then.
Right.
And. And it was—I'm not even sure what the doses was of that, but most of the time, it was you could function within it, you know, barely, I guess, but you could.
Yeah, well, it's the question that I got interested in is if a higher dose took you to places you've never been,
yeah,
and gave you a larger view of reality and also had a lot of therapeutic value, wouldn't it be better to not try and function, but to really spend as much time as you could in the very special space that a psychedelic offers?
I agree with you. I agree with you. And in your sessions, I noticed they were what, 6 to 12 hours long. You had a whole toward the end how to prepare for one and how to and so on and so forth. But do you find people are much more open to this now, or are you finding people coming to you and requesting this kind of therapy, or more so than they ever did?
The therapy, you know, remember, we're still talking about drugs that, even though they have huge amounts of, you know, very good medical results,
right,
the federal government still says they're all illegal. So,
right.
Particularly when you write a book, people do come to you, and you say to them, I'm a very public figure, and I'm not about to recommend that you do something illegal, but I am going to recommend that if you do something illegal, that you do it as carefully and as safely and as well as possible. And
right,
by the way, there's a couple of chapters in my book which outline the safest, best way to use them. So that's what
you need. I was glad you did that, because, and the only reason I say that is because there's so many people experimenting with drugs today, and there always will be, and there always have been. But you dispel a lot of the myths surrounding hallucinogenics, you know, especially LSD and mescaline,
yeah,
and so on. And as far as the toxins that are in it and certain effects that come from it, that have been more of a fear campaign than reality. And maybe
when you're doing disinformation,
just go into some of those to tell people what kind
of
so. What
well,
is
one
it
of
so?
The,
yeah.
I talked to the person who helped develop what's called blotter acid, which is putting a tiny, 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 tiny drop of LSD on a piece of blotter paper. And I said, why did you do that? He said, well, when you put it on blotter paper, because we're dealing with millionths of a gram, you can't put anything else in it. It is kind of pure by, you know, just by the way it's set up.
Right.
Because
yeah, I read that.
Almost
I
anything else is bulky compared to LSD.
Right. And I think you said that what they were stating was that there was some strychnine in involved with that.
There was strychnine, which is kind of a silly rumor if you think about
right.
it. And as it turned out, the famous strychnine-laced LSD has never been found, except in the rumors.
Except in the rumors.
Now, people can hurt themselves using LSD, but not, you know, the magic poisons associated with it are at the same level as your evil neighbor who waits for Halloween in order to poison the neighborhood children.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand. But what's the, like, for instance, if somebody's using, I think there's probably more danger using mushrooms than their side effects to mushrooms than possibly to LSD. Is that correct?
Well, if you eat the wrong mushroom, there is a mushroom called the death cap, and it's very well named. It has about a 20-30% fatality rate. And there's psilocybin, for which we have no recorded deaths ever. So these are very different mushrooms. And
in the last probably 20 years or more. But I can say that when I had them, I had no side effects other than a very nice experience, you know.
Yeah, well, in the 60s, it was said that it was very hard to have a bad trip on mushrooms.
It was, unless
I will accept your wisdom and mine on this one.
Well, you know, it's the same way with it always bothered me. Well, some people had bad experiences on simple pot, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they get extremely paranoid or have or bug out, you know, on the stuff.
Well,
but,
there is
I mean, that never happened to me.
It's not generally known in the and not talked about in the pot world, but a certain percentage of people do have negative experiences on pot, usually paranoia.
Yep.
And you know them because if you're in a group of people who've used pot, they say, I don't use it. And then they tell
That's right.
about the time or two they tried it and it was had a paranoid reaction, and they don't use
right.
it.
Right.
Just as there are people who, when they drink alcohol, they flush. They, you know, they turn beet red.
That's true.
And it's genetic,
yep.
and they don't use alcohol much.
That's true. But it always surprised me, and I guess everybody can have allergic reactions of some sort or weird reactions. But
When people have a bad trip, they're usually not talking about physiology. They're usually about talking that they got into a mental state where they were frightened, where they were upset,
right.
where they didn't understand what was going on,
right.
Where they were with people who they found they didn't like. And it got very difficult. Most people that I see a lot of this, who have had bad trips, say, yes, it's part of what you need to learn to know to take better care of yourself.
That's very true. Especially if you're in a nightclub or if you're in someplace you shouldn't be. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's definitely, not wise to indulge in those areas, but as far I mean even with pot, I mean you can be so laid back in a bar that
sure.
It could be dangerous for you. You know what I mean?
Well, the pot people,
like that, you just gotta
when they're arguing about should pot be legal and available and so forth,
right.
they have this really simple minded argument, which is tobacco kills 400,000 people a year, marijuana
yep.
has killed no one yet.
That's
and then
pretty
they
simple...
just wait for people to say, rrr, 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 rrr.
But yeah, but that's so true.
The thing I think we should keep in mind is you and I are talking a lot about the past, but according to the government, 23 million people in the United States have used LSD. That's a lot.
You know what amazes me is how they can keep track of that?
Well, I think it's probably an underreport.
Unless they're selling it directly to them or something,
Well,
how do they know that?
It's done by asking high school seniors, I believe, every year, kind of what are you using and how often, and then you keep getting a new crop, so you keep adding to your totals.
Yeah. So the government goes out and does a survey, and all these guys say, "Yeah, I'm stoned as hell, and I use this and I use that." Well, now it seems on the rise.
If I had a government survey that said what drugs are you using, I think I would underreport. So when I say 23 million, that's the lowest possible figure that we can come up with. And that figure grows by 400,000 to 600,000 a year. So one of the reasons I wrote the book was for the 400,000 to 600,000 a year who, if they're going to use a psychedelic, then they better be smart.
And know how to do it, right? Know what to do.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the sex education people. They figure you're probably going to have sex, so why not learn something?
That's true. But I think the probably one of the more frightening statistics. Well, I say frightening. I don't necessarily believe it's frightening, but back in I would say probably ten years ago, I remember that. The figure was around 70 million people that had used or are using pot regularly.
In
the United States.
About right.
Now, in I think it's up to 140 million who have used it.
Well, that's throwing in the LSD people as well. So, but let's assume there's 140 million people who've used a drug that the U.S. government has declared to be illegal, one of many drugs.
Right.
And the idea that... that people can, can respect the government for having such laws gets very difficult.
Yeah. Have you found any? I noticed I didn't come across this in your book, but Is there any addiction qualities, addictive qualities to LSD?
Well, what's curious, and Hoffman, the inventor, talks about it, it's anti-addictive, and that's very few substances you can say that. But if you take LSD on day one, and let's say you have a terrific, wonderful time, and you say, gee, I want to do that again, and so you take LSD on day two, nothing happens. And you take LSD on day three, and nothing happens. Your system in some way says you can't take this very often, even at a low dose, because it has no effect.
Right.
That doesn't lead to addiction. Now, are there people who overuse and misuse? Of course.
Yeah, yeah. It's right. You know, it's no different than say pot, because pot is not addictive as well. I mean, you can they're other than psychologically maybe, but
right.
It's not physically addictive. Not like cigarettes and nicotine.
Absolutely.
You know, so but after all these years of experiments dealing with government projects and so on and so forth, what is the rationale, okay, of the government to prevent these harmless drugs, actually, I believe they're harmless, from being prohibited? And yet, and of course, my example is allowing alcohol and tobacco, which kills millions of people, okay, to be regulated and sold.
Well, remember, this is a country that had a prohibition of alcohol.
Yes.
And it led to a huge upsurge in the use of alcohol.
Right.
And there's just one fun statistic, which is if you took a Times Square and drew a big circle around, you know, half a mile.
Right.
Before prohibition, 800 establishments served alcohol. During prohibition, in the same circle, 2,500 establishments served alcohol.
Oh, man, really?
So that was prohibition.
Yeah.
And it looks like we didn't learn much.
No, they didn't learn anything at all. I mean, you know,
original prohibitions on marijuana were pretty correlated with racism.
Oh.
This was not a white person's drug.
Oh, I
and then it
that.
Got out of hand. And the psychedelics, they were banned not for really medical reasons, but for totally political reasons. They seemed to be correlated with people who were against Vietnam, who wanted racial justice, who wanted equality for women, people who were disruptive of the system.
Right.
And
the
government,
drugs.
Was a little confused. It didn't know what to do. And so it stopped all the research, which, of course, did nothing to stop all the use.
Right.
So it's a you know, 100 years from now, it'll be looked upon as one of the great follies of legislation, and it's going away. You know, California and 16 other states are saying, if marijuana seems to help your medical condition, well, you should be allowed, as a right as a citizen, to do that which helps your physical condition.
Now, I'm not sure. I mean, I would think that you would have looked into this as well. But I mean, when you think that that so much of the underground economy is fueled by drugs, you know, illegal drugs. I had an interview with former CIA
operative.
Agent. Last year, and he said that the drug company, that the entire world, I mean, most of these, not only just, I mean, most of these drug cartels, if you will, are funded by major corporations, okay, and all of the money is laundered by major banks, all right?
Well,
and this is where, these monies, he says, are what is actually keeping economies afloat. He says
When
cash.
When you interviewed this person, that was really correct, and there was a wonderful report from the UN that said the illegal drug money, and the figure they gave was $200 billion. They said that was the only fluid capital available at the height of the sudden economic meltdown.
Yeah.
And of course it went through major banks. Who else could it go through?
Yeah. I mean, Wells Fargo, I believe, was one of the Wells Fargo, Wachovia, all of these guys. These were all huge money launderers, you know.
Yeah. Well, as far as we know.
Yeah.
And you know, who else? You know, if you're going to have a lot of money, of course it's going to go through banks. And whether it goes through banks being washed and dried or just laundered, the banks honestly are not in the business of deciding whose money they like the best.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Whose money do they like the best? The money that they don't have to declare is the money they like the best, I guess.
That's true.
Yeah, you know another thing that surprised me, I read this years ago, and I believe it's still valid, is mm-hmm. that, for instance, Coca-Cola
right.
has the only, still has a valid license. And is the only one ever that was ever allowed by in this country to import raw coca.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, Coca-Cola's original
They're still doing it.
Formula.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Yeah. What's up?
Coca-Cola's original formula contained what we would now call cocaine.
Yeah, which is cocaine.
And it was very popular.
Oh, extremely so. In fact, there was something I read a number of years ago that one of the causes of the Great Depression was when they banned cocaine from Coca-Cola. It was right around 1909. Yeah, yeah.
But what we do know is that coca, before you refine it,
yeah.
Is, again, it seems to be a very sensible, low-level stimulant drug that's particularly
mm-hmm.
helpful if you live in the high mountains of Bolivia and Peru.
Right.
And allows you to function in
right.
a normal way and in a healthy way. If it's refined right. and concentrated, cocaine is not good for you.
Right. Well, depending on who's snorting it, I guess. But the thing that always amazed me are the black operations that are funded by this illegal. This illegal industry, and that's why I believe it's not ever going to be stopped. You know.
Well, let me give you an example of how it what happens when it stops. Portugal, about 9 years ago, made all drugs, including the worst ones, legal.
Yes, they made them legal.
They also said if you're not using them well, if you're in trouble, it is legal to get treatment. And
right.
there's plenty of treatment available. Now, what
right.
happened is, of course, the crime money, you know, went elsewhere.
Right.
And the use of all drugs that are illegal in the United States, marijuana
mm-hmm.
through heroin, declined.
Right.
So that having it available and legal lowered the use.
That's right.
Remember the Times Square statistic I gave you for prohibition?
Right, right.
So if we really wanted to deal with the drug problem in this country, we would
mm-hmm.
take the profit out of it and put the medical intervention back in.
Oh, absolutely. I fully agree with you. And I don't understand why, other than the fact that there are too many big interests that don't want that to happen because they're profiting from it. You know, from it being illegal.
Well, the tragedy
the
is how much of the law enforcement industry is fueled, or not fueled by, but funded by drug seizures.
That's right.
A couple of years ago, Los Angeles seized $7 million worth, or made $7 million in assets they seized from people for drug arrests. That's not the drugs. That's just their other property. And it's in their budget.
There you go.
So it's very hard to ask people to say, you know, cut things out of your budget, have less need for police, less need for equipment,
right.
et cetera.
Right.
Very hard to ask a business to downscale just because it would be better for the culture.
Right. Now, I was going to ask you about some of the guys that you've worked with over the years, that you mentioned in your book here.
Sure.
For instance, did you know Aldous Huxley?
I knew Huxley just a little bit.
Yeah.
I was young. He was already elderly.
Yeah.
And we spent a little bit of time together, and I was, I can't say we were, you know, he was friendly to me because I was a nice kid. I was a graduate student, but I was a nice kid.
Right.
And he was this wonderful, delicate, erudite, just amazingly calm and lovely human being.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I found it fascinating, actually, to find out that he was a major eugenicist. I mean, he believed in culling the population.
Well, there were a lot of people who talked about psychedelics and said they should be for the better educated, the better prepared people with spiritual training. And there was a whole thing in the United States. Remember, the federal government was doing eugenics experiments, and among other people that were funding it were the Rockefellers. So it was a theory in America for a while that you should get rid of the people who were not the best.
Right.
So it was unfortunately true in Europe, and it was true in the United States. And it's more, I think, historical than you can pin it on.
He had so many guys like Bertrand Russell and Huxley and so many of these guys, Bernard Shaw, you know, who had such contempt for the poor and for the unfortunate, it seemed.
Well, are you saying there's no major forces in the United States now that seem to have contempt for the poor? Come on.
The entire Republican, entire Republican Party, as well as a good portion of the Democratic Party.
Okay,
and,
so maybe eugenics is on its way back, and what a horrible thought.
I know, it's frightening, isn't it? I admired his work, but I always thought it was, philosophy on calling the population.
Well,
and his elitism.
Again, you know, just as, you know, you really have to separate kind of the historical context for any
right.
of these guys.
Yeah.
Just as we now at the moment in the United States, you ask most people on the street and an awful lot of well-educated people, you know, are Muslims inherently bad people? And they will say,
yeah, really.
Well, I don't know any, but I'm sure they are.
Yeah, exactly. That's
so
true.
You know, and 20 years from now, you're going to, you know, someone like you is going to talk to someone like me and say, do you know who was against Muslims in those days? You can't
That's
imagine.
True. True. I was impressed with the preparation of your book because it seems like how many experiences have you had with LSD? I mean,
actually had less experiences than a large amount of your audience, who's probably 22. The difference is that I've had primarily very high-dose experiences under very substantial conditions with teachers. And what we learned and what we really researched is it took 6 to 12 months before you got all the benefit kind of squeezed out of what you'd learned. So you have to remember that my book is really only about the various ways that one benefits from using these substances. And
right.
that there's lots of ways not to benefit, and lots of other people have already written about that.
Well, has LSD shown any signs of driving people insane or causing any mental illness?
Only when it's taken in a terrible setting, and then it's the terrible setting that drives the person to be upset. And then if they're hospitalized by people that have no idea what's going on, then they can be further upset. Now, one of my graduate students a few years ago told me, you know, that a number of years ago he'd had a terrible experience, which was handled very poorly, and he was hospitalized, and it took him a long time to recover. And then I met him in graduate school, and he's gone on to become a very fine clinical psychologist. But he blames not the psychedelic, but on the way people then began to drug him with tranquilizers and so forth and so on, and put him in an institution which terrified him.
Yeah, that happened to a friend of mine too. It wasn't the drug, it wasn't the acid trip so much as the repercussions he had. He had to quit college because of that.
So I think people forget is these are really powerful mental openers. And if you open too much too fast in a situation where you're not secure, you're going to be frightened, and then you open to the fear, and that gets more.
You can get
very serious trouble. What we found, on the other hand, is when you do it in the right way with people who know what they're doing, safe and secure, that people recover from a lot of mental illness. Wonderful work done in Canada with alcoholism, where they took long, you know, hardcore alcoholics and one LSD session under these good situations, and they had about a 50% abstinent rate. Now, that's up from about 1%.
Wow.
And at one point in Saskatchewan, it was no longer experimental. It was a standard treatment that was available only, of course, to people who'd been trained in how to use it.
Right, yeah.
So we're talking about something that has remarkable healing qualities as well as remarkably upsetting qualities.
Well, I understand that. I understand the upsetting qualities and the money drugs only because it's no different than prescription drugs. If you overdo it, or if you're emotionally upset or whatever, things can bring on palpitations. They can bring on anxiety attacks. They can bring on, paranoia. You know, that kind of thing.
It doesn't bring them on because physiologically none of that occurs, but being frightened brings all that on.
Being frightening brings that on, yes,
yeah,
right.
And you can be frightened, you know, you don't need a psychedelic to be frightened.
No, you don't. One thing I wanted to talk about tonight was the use of LSD as a portal to the different dimensions. We talk a lot on this show about trans-dimensional travel, if you will.
Right.
Using psychedelics is definitely one way to get there. In your experiments or in your own personal journeys, have you transcended fourth, fifth, and further on dimensions? Have you experienced those, or have they become more or less integrated in your own?
What we found in working with LSD, and then I'm going to change drugs for a moment, but let me finish with LSD.
Right. Yeah.
Is people would have what they would call spiritual experiences, where they felt in tune with all life, where they felt they were eternal in some sense, in a very Christian sense, that they'd lived before in reincarnation in a Hindu sense. So they ran smack into the center of the major spiritual systems. Now that was with LSD. Now, if we switch drugs for a moment to something called DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which actually is found in the cells of the body and in the brain, but in small amounts, a larger amount, people often report that they have been into a literal another dimension and where there are other beings who have other machinery and, you know, other colored faces, and who are terribly aware that these people have arrived in their dimension. Now, DMT only lasts about 15 minutes, so we don't have, you know, long stories.
Right.
But we definitely have lots and lots and lots of that from DMT. And
right.
we also have something called ayahuasca, which is from South America, and people have adventures or experiences with entities and with animals and with animal spirits, as they call them, and with plants as teachers. So there's a whole lot of, there's a whole range of possibilities with different psychedelics.
Oh, yeah. Now, the reason I mention that is because I know personally a number of clairvoyants and people that are attuned to the, to other higher dimensions, but I myself have experienced the alternative dimensions,
right.
and have seen these sides. But and of course we read about them through history, where others have experienced them.
Absolutely.
As well. You know, Swedenborg and others, but the I guess what I'm getting at is when my experience happened, which was a number of years ago, probably 10 years ago, 15 years ago,
mm-hmm.
it was reoccurring because I was able to even without drugs, was able to once I created the portal.
Right.
I was able to go back and forth. You know what I mean? It was upon call. You know.
Sure.
And I've had close friends who have experienced this interdimensional travel, where they've had. You mentioned this oddly enough in your book. I noticed. That's why I bring it up.
Right.
Where they've had angels or gods, you know, or enlightened beings approach them. As they've entered and this
you know,
has happened.
There are a lot
number
of places
of,
where
I know,
the science that we've been taught clearly it's correct as far as it goes, but it doesn't take in, you know, the kind of experiences you had, and the
right.
fact that the experience you had, and you have lots of lots of people who've had it, and I know lots of people who've had it. In my world, science is free to look at everything. It doesn't
right.
make an arbitrary rule that says, well, that can't exist, so I won't look.
Right.
That takes us right back to, you know, Galileo, who said, mm-hmm. you know, don't tell me there aren't rings around Saturn. Just look in this little telescope.
Exactly.
And the theologians basically said, if I look and I see it, I'm in serious trouble, so why don't I just say it isn't so and
right.
tell you to, you know, to cool it and shut up and not talk about these things, because
that's happening
we've
now.
Decided
yeah.
they aren't so.
Good
and
Lord,
science,
I mean,
unfortunately, it's... now and then does the same thing until, you know, some amazing piece of data happens.
Yeah.
Let me give you an example. Acupuncture is now relatively well accepted throughout the United States as one of the ways you can get help for various medical conditions.
Right.
But I recall when learned people said it can't exist because there aren't flows of energy in the body.
Right.
It just can't be. And you'd say, well, how about the 2,000 or 3,000 years of medicine in China and Japan? They say, well, they're foreign. They don't count. And then
right.
James Reston, reporter for the New York Times, had his appendix out in Beijing using only acupuncture. And he said, I think it exists because I had it done on me, and I assure you, I am, you know, I'm not a crank, I'm not a scientist, but I
right.
have a huge audience of people who just read my article.
Wow.
And so that's
there
how
you go.
These things kind of move forward.
Right, right.
Now,
they do.
As to what, you know, what's going on in the other dimensions, and how much is in your own mind, and how much the other dimensions live inside your own mind, you know, we haven't been able to do much research.
Well, this was what I wondered. Really, was how many dimensions are within our own mind? I mean, as many as we can possibly imagine. And,
well, I like
and
the science fiction idea, which is more that there's parallel worlds.
Excuse me.
And there are worlds, you know, right next to ours, and then you don't have to worry about the numbers. When you
right.
talk about dimensions, and people think that well, there are three dimensions, and maybe time's a fourth dimension. As soon as you start thinking five and six, you don't know quite where to put them.
Well, actually,
so
according to...
I like to just think there are places next door
there are,
that I haven't been to.
about 144 dimensions, which include overtones. And, so it's like, I don't know if you're familiar with the works of Drunvalo Melchizedek. You are. He was from the 144th dimension.
I'll tell you a story. This is in South America. Someone who took ayahuasca and was very frightened by some dragons that he met, who said they controlled the kind of creation and destruction of the worlds. And they didn't seem to him to be very nice beings. And the next day, he talked to the shaman and told him that he had had this terrible experience with the dragons. And the dragons, the shaman laughed and said, "Oh, those dragons always say that. They don't control much at all."
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
So, you know, again, if you think about all the lying we have in this dimension, the idea that you would get totally perfect information in another dimension, I'm not convinced.
But even in the fourth dimensional existence, where, you know, that is a rather a murky place to be, because you're dealing with totally dealing with your emotions that are feeding your basically what they do now. But you're in a time space continuum here where you're not in the fourth dimension. It's immediate. What you think you actually manifest within that second, and then onward to the fifth, sixth dimensions. If you which are more, you know, or less of a physical and more of a spiritual existence, you know. But the awareness of these dimensions, okay, is what I think is critical. You can only experience these higher dimensions either through focused meditation or through, you know, a psychedelic experience, you know, or
through
drug.
Fasting or through chanting or through prayer.
Exactly.
There are lots
of
ways.
Whatever it is that you to alter your state, you know, your physical state. And then you realize that these things exist and you say, "Holy cow," and then you go beyond that and you research and go further, and then you find yourself totally overwhelmed by the possibilities of where you can go at that point, you know.
Feeling, you know, if you ever try it, it's very, very strange. If you just go out and lie down at night in a meadow when you can get a good look at the stars,
right?
And it's a fascinating thing. You just start to look at the stars and begin to feel how many there are and how small you are. And at some point you find that you just stop. You just don't want to feel that way.
That's true.
When we talk about the other dimensions, most people can barely cope with the dimensions they've got.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
And so my work is really very kind of simple-minded and practical, which is I'd like people's lives to work better, to be less neurotic, to be less frightened of other dimensions or of this dimension, and that psychedelics seems to be incredibly useful.
The big exciting use is
people with post-traumatic stress disorder. We're talking about, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of vets coming back whose minds are in bad shape, and it looks like MDMA or ecstasy with therapy seems to be a remarkable breakthrough in this area. And that, to me, is one of the very exciting new things that's happened that wasn't true in the 60s. And the government is actually not stopping the research, but kind of supporting it.
Right.
So there's exciting things happening.
Yeah, I would think that under post-traumatic stress, psychedelics would be, you know, could be harmful more so, you know, bring back a lot of, since most of that is all emotional, it would bring up a lot of emotional.
Ecstasy is not a full psychedelic in that sense. It allows you to re-experience a very traumatic incident, but without being upset.
Oh, that's
being re-frightened and re-kind of, you know, going through it in the ugly way. But the way, you know, if you think about it, let's say you were bullied and beaten up in grammar school.
Right.
And at this point in your life, you can look back on that pretty objectively and remember how upset you were, but it doesn't upset you. And so what we're finding with ecstasy is that, and in, again, safe therapeutic situation, that people can re-experience the events, but they are not re-traumatized. And the results are that people who've, you know, been unable to work because they're so traumatized are now back with full-time jobs. And that to me is a very simple-minded way of saying, does it help?
Yeah, that's great. Now, I've always believed in that drugs were therapeutic, and, you know, in reasonable doses in certain drugs. You know, there are others that are quite frightening. But those particular ones that you've talked about seem to be great. And I don't know. I don't have anything against them. I was going to say that one of the greatest experiences I ever had that I can recall. I was only, I think I was 18, and some friends and I spent a night on a beach. We were in Maine, lived in Maine actually, but we were on the coast of Maine and we lived. And this is a fall, and we brought this huge canvas down there and spent the night on the beach. Yep. And we had all done mescaline and whatever else we had. But the mescaline was remarkable in the sense that that I remember being under the starry sky. You know, the sky was clear. Right. And in Maine, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but sky was peppered with salt and peppered with stars that night.
Yeah, no, you really could see the whole sky, right?
Yeah, you could see the entire sky, and you're on the ocean, you know, and it was just unbelievable. But I remember the colors and patterns that started to happen and before me, and I remember them because they suddenly this chaotic mess of I shouldn't say mess but this blast of stars, I mean billions of stars, suddenly started to take on a form and patterns.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I started to see them, but not in your distinct patterns of, you know, the Big Dipper and the Orion, but in these unique, strange, not even strange, they were almost, what's the word for it?
Psychedelic is actually the word.
What? What's the word?
Psychedelic is actually the word.
Psychedelic, yeah, but I could see these moving patterns of Arabic motifs, you know, and arches and shapes and things, and then I understand for some reason, and I had no real knowledge of Arabian architecture or anything at that time, other than having seen pictures and whatnot.
Sure.
But the entire sky started to totally understand. And I got very seriously into Arab mysticism, you know, after that, because I understood, for some reason, was attracted to the and understood the beauty and depth of the architecture, based upon the strange patterns and motifs that I saw in the sky that night. And
well, interesting thought. Take it the other way, and then imagine that the people who actually built those buildings had a similar experience to yours.
Of course. But
we're seeing in many things that people, you know, get in awe of and have a moment of inner quiet is those resemble patterns which their own mind has seen in the larger universe.
Oh sure, and at that point, and I thought, because in the Middle East, I mean everything. I mean you had of course the magic mushrooms, but you had also had hashish, and you had tremendous use of a lot of different hallucinogenic drugs, And I could see how these things were created, you know, for some reason. And,
well,
and
there's
a
whole theory out there that humanity itself, civilization, started to move forward when people began to discover that if they ate certain mushrooms and so forth,
right,
that they had experiences that actually left them with very strong impressions in their brains, and the theory goes, began to raise their IQ.
Oh, I believe that. I honestly believe that. And it gives you, for some reason, each experience that I had just, I don't know, exploded something inside me where I was able to grasp some other higher concept of some sort, you know?
Yeah, well, I share your kind of experience.
Yeah.
I was a little older.
Yeah.
But again, I had this very transformative experience, and I also became deeply interested in mysticism. And I must say, if there is a, you know, a substance which gets people interested in mysticism and religious systems, that sounds like an okay substance to me.
It does, doesn't it? You know, after those early experiences, and I had many of them running through my 20s, some because I had started to study different yoga techniques, different meditations, and different religions, but and also was doing some was still continuing some, you know, I was using mescaline and some other things that induced that, mushrooms and whatnot, but I think during that period but it's funny, you know, like you have enough, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like
that's
enough. I didn't need it anymore. I didn't want it anymore, really. It was enough. I was like, okay, I got to get on now. You know what I mean? It's like,
well,
that's it.
I think
it.
Alan Watts says, when you get the message, even if it's from God, after you get the message, you hang up the phone.
That's absolutely right. It's absolutely right. And I haven't touched those things in years, but it's like years.
Well,
and
when we were talking earlier about how they're not addictive, what they are is learning experiences.
That's right.
And learning,
and I found that I could transform.
Learning may be addictive, but not
those areas
not
without
drugs.
I was able to just move into those different dimensions without it, and it was a wonderful experience for me. And at that point, I didn't need those that experimental stuff anymore.
Well,
and
you
will
be a role model for the 400,000 to 600,000 people that'll try LSD for the first time this year in the United States.
Yeah, well, it should be. I just hope that they read your book and take the. I didn't have the advantage of that and had to go through some interesting times, but
well, let us say
that the
psychedelic explorer's guide,
right,
very carefully. The title is very careful. And it's talking about safe, therapeutic, and sacred journeys. And it's to make those more likely so that people will have more of the kind of experience you talked about on the beach in Maine and not the kind that gets people into trouble.
No, and hopefully if they do have to do this, then they do it properly, but they do it with the right attitude, you know.
Yep.
So, you know, not do anything crazy and go walk into the ocean and drown, but, you know, instead just sit there and contemplate where you are and what an incredible universe it is. And I think that if anything, I can say that's what these did for me back many years ago. And
according to the people that I talked to who are in their 20s,
those experiences
still occur.
Yes.
But again, they occur when people, you know what they're doing.
And, you know, I can honestly say I never had any flashbacks, okay, other than
that's
pleasant
rare
memories, remember,
people,
you know, like I described and things like that.
Flashbacks are a lot rarer than people think and often come when an experience has been prematurely stopped, again, sometimes with medical intervention. But
right.
What people have is very fond memories, which is just what you did, right now, yeah, talking about when you were 18. You had a very strong memory, but it was not a flashback, as you knew it was a memory and that you knew you were enjoying it as we talked.
Absolutely. But I've had horrible flashbacks of my of divorce, you know what I mean, or relationships and stuff like that, where you go, oh, you know, like that kind of thing. Whoa, get out of my head, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, yes.
But, those weren't drug-induced, but those were, you know, just memories that you really wouldn't rather have anymore.
Exactly.
But you can't blame that on LSD. But I was thinking that if there was any way that I could, without tipping the scales toward, promoting drug use, you know, I don't want to sound hypocritical because I've used them, but I do want to just say that using them safe and using them in a way to that, you know, that'll guide you in a spiritual direction.
Right.
I don't know. I can't see anything wrong with that. I never did.
Neither of us are promoting drug use, but both of us are promoting safe and sacred drug use.
Yes. Yes.
Just as if we were, you know, if I was a sex educator and you'd say, "Are you promoting sex?" And I would say, well, in the first place, I don't have to.
Right.
And in the second place, no, I'm not promoting sex. I'm promoting safe sex.
I was promoting
sacred
safe
sex. You know, sex that transforms your life in a positive way.
Right. Right.
So here we are.
And you know, another thing I was going to ask you, if you had ever heard of this, because I know you go into some of the shamanic things toward the end of the book.
Yeah.
But have you ever known anyone to use Palo Santo as a are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
The holy wood from South America. Okay. It's
but there's a lot of substances that do a lot of things to a lot of people.
Yeah. No, actually it's a dead tree seasoned for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. All right, before they're allowed to cut it. You know, it's supposed to fall naturally in the forest, the rainforest, and then it dies and it forms naturally. It seasons naturally for 5 years before, by law, they're not allowed to cut it until there, because it's a sacred incense. And I've tried it, and a friend of mine gave it to me, and he said, "Try this and burn it and see what you think." And it's very very inexpensive. You can buy it online, and it's called Palo Santo. And it's a very, very pleasant incense supposedly has spiritual, you know, shamanic qualities to it, which I believe using it, I said, wow, yeah, this does do something to you.
Well,
but
I appreciate the advice.
What's up?
I appreciate your advice and suggestion.
Yeah, Palo Santo is quite an unusual and a wonderful smelling incense as well. So, but approved by South American shamans. So there you go. I just wanted to bring that up in our conversation. I've enjoyed tonight. I really did. And how's your book doing, by the way?
Well, it's hard to tell. It seems to be doing pretty well. The publisher's happy.
He is. Oh, that's good. That's
I'm
always good.
Happy, and various people have invited me onto their shows, as you have.
Right.
And that's always a good sign.
Well, I learned about your show from Anthony Bryce. You did his show last
week. Oh, Anthony's such a beautiful guy.
Isn't he a nice guy? Yeah. He's a prince. But he told me about you, and I said, "Oh man, that's straight up that's something I'd love to have you on." And
well, pass me on to a friend of yours, and I will be delighted.
Yeah. But anyway, I wish you all the best. Oh, and by the way, I've looked at your website, the blog, and you are a remarkable photographer, by the way. I being one myself, I was very, very impressed with some of your work there that you had displayed. And
thank you. Thank you. JamesFadiman.com has kind of samples of various things I do. And the photography is one way of getting into perhaps the same place that you got into that beach in Maine.
You're right there. There's no question about it. And some of those pictures, you're right there. You're natural. I do a lot of nature pictures, so I know what you're working with. And when you mentioned, I was listening to Anthony, your interview with Anthony, and I really, really enjoyed what you said about your pictures talk to you, you know, or not your pictures, but your flowers. You know,
yeah, the flowers, right. When you're in a certain state of mind, you see so much beauty everywhere.
Yes,
and then
you
when you look through the camera lens, it's still there.
Yep.
And sometimes when you look at the pictures later, when you're not in the same state, it's still there. And those are wonderful photographs.
Oh, they are, yeah.
As you know, since you go out in nature for the same reason I do.
Yeah, every season I take a slew. I use a digital format nowadays, but because I can shoot so many pictures on one, you know, at one setting.
Right.
But I found that they talk to you, you know, and it's only when you're in the garden or when you're in the flower garden. Like we have a tremendous number of flowers, and my girlfriend is a gardener. And she loves, she plants these incredible flowers all around the house every year. And so, and we have trees and, you know, all kinds of stuff. So, but I find that every year I have to, these plants, these flowers just call. Come take my picture, you know what I mean?
You know, I'm out here looking beautiful. What are you doing in the house?
Exactly, you know, and they say, well, it's raining out. You know, well, I look great in the rain, too, so, yeah, but my camera doesn't work so good out there. You know, you're constantly looking at things and going, they almost talk to you, you know. And what you've captured, the sacred geometry within each flower that just, it blows you away and puts you into that life that you are capturing in your frame is totally compelling, you know. And I can see that in
you're
in
wonderful.
Your
and I tried to get one of my flowers for the cover of the book.
Yes.
And my publisher and I agreed that it wasn't far enough out for quite what they wanted it to look like. So they took a flower and put it into a slightly altered state for the cover, and it works pretty well.
Yeah, I thought I like the cover actually.
I really like the cover.
Yeah, but you are a great photographer, and I hope you continue that, and I hope to see more of it.
I thank Anthony for bringing that up, and you for going to my website and seeing some. You make me very clear that I need to put up some of my more current work.
Oh yeah, you got some beautiful stuff there. Just the five or six pictures you have there were outstanding, and I'd highly recommend that. As a photographer, that you put them out there, I don't know if you're on Facebook. I think you should get a Facebook account put some of your. There are some photo. I have a number of them on my on my Facebook. A number of photography groups, internet and Facebook photography groups that post some outstanding photos as well as their own paintings and things like that.
Sure.
And I just get bombarded with such beautiful work a lot of the time that you would a lot of people would appreciate your stuff.
That's a lovely idea. I am on Facebook. And
yep.
I haven't put any of my photography up.
You have to.
And I think that's just a great idea. Thank you.
Absolutely. And if you are on Facebook, I'm going to send you a friend invitation, by the way. So,
great.
I'll check that out. But, you definitely, you definitely got to put some of that stuff
by
up.
By the way, where are you in the physical three-dimensional universe?
Oh, Salisbury, Connecticut.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay, I lived in Greenwich at one point.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
You were in the Eastern Establishment here. So you were in Harvard as well, right?
Well,
were you at Harvard?
I left the Eastern establishment pretty quickly.
Yeah, I don't know.
I grew up in Los Angeles, but I was I almost lived in Greenwich. I did for a summer and then decided that I was going to go back to California and go back to high school.
Oh, well, that was probably a good idea. But, you know, I just think that, no, I just wanted to mention there were two or three pictures that you had put up there that knocked me out. One of them was the picture of the impressions in the window, you know, that old window.
Oh, yeah.
Man, that was a great one. That was a great picture,
oh,
and
thank
so
you.
Was meditative rock, the one in the mist, in the waterfall.
Oh yes.
And I mean, those are brilliant shots. I don't know where you were, if there was ever a Zen moment for you, those were Zen moments.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's what you're getting is I would get into that space,
yeah.
And then you know look around. And
but that's exactly what we're talking about.
And that's what you do when you go to your girlfriend's house.
You're
not with her, maybe. You're out in the garden.
Inner dimension that exists within nature, you know.
Yeah.
And it just blows me away constantly. That's why I take so many pictures of nature pictures. But I've also been fascinated by portraits and people. So
I must say, I can't do portraits well. My daughter, who is has been a professional photographer, a journalist photographer, just is wonderful with people. And
really,
I need the living thing to sit still a little bit. And that's the wonderful thing about flowers, is they're great. You know, you ask them to pose, and they all
they pose for you. Yeah, it's true. It's true. I love nature, and I just can't I can't get enough of that. And,
well, I will kind of blend our two topics here for a moment, which is Albert Hofmann, the inventor of LSD, was asked about, as he was always, you know, how should I use LSD? And he said, and I'm quoting him and using his accent, always take it in nature.
Oh, yeah.
So he was a great believer that taking these substances in a natural setting, like the beach in Maine, is the best way.
Well, I always believed after many experiences I've had in nature as well that with the use of nature, guys like Henry Thoreau, who knew every plant that grew and everything that you know and when it was going to grow and what time of the year it grew. I can't believe that guy wasn't smoking or taking a few mushroom heads or something, and of course his best buddy Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson. I don't know how he could have created transcendentalism without some guided
without a little help from his friends. Right?
Exactly. So you know, and reading their stuff and understanding their work. And knowing where their heads were at they've been great inspirations to me. But I knew that they couldn't achieve that level without some aid
somewhere. Kind of help.
That's right.
Right.
Just
and whether it was help from their own meditation
or from a whiff or something,
we don't know. But we're just glad they wrote it so they make it a little easier for us to kind of, you know, to get into their shoes and walk that path.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why your book does so much, because I think it, you know, it touches on enough people and gives a little insight into their history and not demonizing them, but humanizing them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I picked that chapter with all those first-person accounts of their first experience. And that
was what I thought made it interesting
because we all have had a first experience.
Right.
And when someone has, well, I've had 300, you know, I've taken acid 300 times, well, their 301st experience, I'm honestly not very interested.
That's true. The 304th experience, it doesn't really matter, but that first few.
Yeah, but that first one where you say, oh, my goodness, the world is larger and more beautiful than I'd ever imagined possible.
Yeah.
That's worth noticing.
Yeah. And it also, I wanted to just add that, you know, wherever your head's at that time, all right, is extremely important as to what you're going to experience, I think. And,
well, that's critical. It's you know, it's what I call set and setting, which
right.
is really what's your mental attitude and what's the physical space and the people around you.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, if you can imagine what it would be like being in an abandoned subway tunnel. It's not a great place for it.
Yeah, yeah. I just have to mention this because this was during that same period when not the same night, but another a few months later when I was in this house with a group of folks, and it was a very old home and very old house, and the guy only had a fireplace going, but it was one of these big old a big house, you know, like I don't know, 5,000 square feet.
Sure.
But the guy, there was no way the guy could heat it, and you know he's living there in the summer, and this was in the late fall now, and October or say, and it got pretty cold up there in Maine at that point. But we were all huddled around the big living room, and of course we were all you know doing masculine, and we and oddly enough, sitting in that huge, I'll never forget it as long as I live. He had this massive old grand piano, okay? You know these ornate grand pianos, and you know, it was gold colored and they had all scrolls and all this kind of stuff on it.
Yeah,
remember
yeah.
how they made pianos back in the 1800s? And it was like, it was so Baroque and everything. And, of course, it had never been tuned. In years, and it had just been in that old house. But the amazing thing that I remember, and this is what, this is why I always believed there was, you know, there was other dimensions, even within the third dimension,
mm-hmm.
was that suddenly in this massive room, like this the big living room, there was about four people sitting there, and suddenly I remember I could see this piano transform into the center of the room, okay, into this about something like three times larger than it was, all right?
Right.
And then I remember walking over to it, sitting down, and playing some kind of concerto on it, okay? This thing that having absolutely no, totally out of tune, all right?
Wow.
And then realizing, and then seeing an entire, as though I was being zapped into another dimension,
mm-hmm.
and,
sure.
you know, into another total dimension, okay, into a vertical, what can I say, a linear, almost like a, I don't know if I can even describe it, but
mm-hmm.
the room became enormous, and I became just zoomed out of the room sitting at that piano. Did that make any sense? Well, I'll never forget that experience because it was one of the most bizarre I ever did. And I did know how to play piano, by the way, but it didn't sound too good. It was very dissonant, whatever the chords were. But I'll never forget that because that piano grew to me like three times the size of its normal, and the room became probably five or six times larger than it was.
Yep. Yep.
And then all of a sudden, you know, in a rush, the piano and I seemed to disappear. And I don't
yep.
know if that made any sense, but
it makes sense. No, I'm thinking of the experience in my book that Van Groff talks about, where he's, you know, he's in a laboratory in Czechoslovakia, and then he's rising up, and he's above the laboratory, and then he's above the town, and then he's above the whole world.
Oh.
Just as if, you know, his mind actually then looks down on the whole world, and then he goes farther than that.
No,
so you
I
left,
this
you and the piano
without,
left, but you, you know.
But it was on it.
Makes
to
total
ask.
Sense to me.
Are you familiar with the work of Preston Nichols, by any chance? Have you ever heard of him?
No.
Okay. Well, he knew he was involved somewhat in the same programs. He's a physicist, but in government programs and stuff. But he designed this incredible. He designed the Wall of Sound for Phil Spector. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Later, he worked in. He became the president of Buddha Records, and then he designed the. He designed the actual sound studio for Abbey Road. Okay, for
wow.
for the Beatles studio.
Yeah.
All right. And he's involved with all with the incredible electromagnetic fields and sounds. And what he did is he created this a machine, all right, which I have experienced. I've been on it with several friends of mine. And it's the same machine. He says that Paul McCartney and George Harrison and I believe John Lennon and a number of others had used this. And what it did was it was designed so that you had these, it was in this room and you had these speakers, and it was like a tilted bed, not a bed, but a cot, like a inclined,
sure.
Bed like, but it was inclined, and you had a speaker underneath, and you had speakers at all four corners of the room, and they were fine tuned to this, you know, frequency. And you could choose whatever music that you just wanted. You had thousands of CDs and on tape and whatnot, and you could
sure.
choose whatever you wanted. And I wanted an indigenous Indian tune, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Flute, you know, Indian flute, and American Indian. And I laid on this cot, and there was some psychedelic lights on the top of the bed, over the top. And as you laid there, you know, you closed your eyes, and the music came on, and the vibrations, all right, that were created in that directed at you,
sure,
allowed you to have an out of body experience. And what this guy said, what you just said about the guy going above the room, above the town,
right.
above the earth,
right?
I was actually, you know, oddly enough. Saw myself as an eagle perched on a felt myself
right.
as an eagle perched on a tree
mm-hmm.
overlooking in a forest overlooking a lake. I could feel it was the most weird feeling, but the music was indigenous, you know, American
sure.
Indian music, flute music, and as I got there, as I recognized what I was, looking out. I was actually a spirit within this eagle, and then I took flight, and all I could see was what before me. I saw the forest, and then I took flight over this lake,
mm-hmm.
and as I took flight over the lake, I became incredibly light. I could see everything. Okay. Everything in perfect vision, and over this entire lake, the horizon was a huge mountain, and I climbed up over the mountain, soared over the mountain, and turned into a plasmic kind of being that encompassed the entire world.
Mm.
Now that was the vision that I got from this experience that wasn't drug induced. It was just simply from this. You know, this machine that he had.
Well, let us say
had.
That he understood the human body and mind and how music
this
takes you places. One of the
things
we always did with our psychedelic clients is the first few hours they would have headphones and music.
Right.
So that they would have the what you got from the studio. And they were aided, of course, by a psychedelic.
By psychedelics, yeah.
So the combination was
I can imagine.
As good as yours in the studio without anything.
Yeah, that would be great. I can almost see what that experience enhanced by LSD or enhanced by, you know, a psychedelic mushroom of some sort. Would have just been unbelievable. I mean,
unbelievable enough. I think you did fine.
It was. It was a great, great, wonderful experience. In fact,
you've had a wonderful set of experiences.
Where they that experienced that had remarkable visions as well. Remarkable visions as well. So
is part of that why you got into doing these kinds of wonderful programs?
No, actually, I've been doing them. I've been doing them since 1999. Started on television and then worked into radio and had an FM show for about 8 or 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
It got sold out to NPR. The station got sold out to NPR. But
right.
I've been doing this one for 5 years on the Blog Talk Radio on the Internet program. And, of course, I've been right. I've got a website I've had up for since 2004, and I got a book published, and I got a number of things going. But this is just something that this has been where we're at, and what we've been trying to, we've been talking about this and mind calendar and spiritual concepts for the last, the last 5 years on this particular program.
No,
so
I assume we're not on air anymore, are we?
Actually, we're not, but we're being recorded. Okay, so I still have 27 more minutes left to recording time here. So this will be on the air. Yeah.
All right. So what is lovely is one of the things that you're making clear is that, and it's really nice because you used psychedelics and had some very meaningful experiences,
mm-hmm.
and you had some equally meaningful experiences, equally visionary, without psychedelics.
Exactly.
And so what that
exactly,
tells me
yeah.
is that it must be your mind is what we're looking at.
Well, I question, quite frankly, whether or not it is, because I wonder if I had actually opened a portal early on through those early psychedelic trips.
Sure.
Right.
And therefore, it's easier for you to open the portal than other people.
Yeah, possibly.
Well, makes sense to me.
But I think that's why my own journey went the way it did, only because I never saw things again the same way, you know.
Right,
that,
exactly. Well, that's why I call them, that's why I talk about learning rather than just experiences.
Ah, yeah.
You know, it's like
if
you go on a roller coaster ride, it's an experience.
Right.
But it's hard
to
say you learned anything.
That's true.
But if you go on one of these rides,
and you
as you say, you never see things the same again, that says you learned something, that you shifted the way you hold the world.
That's right. No,
and,
that's so true.
And
well,
what I've found
it does change your positive shift. Yeah, I think so. I've always believed that, but again, the problem is we forget. You know, once we go beyond and the world being as it is tells
right.
you know, puts these things down, makes them illegal, makes them, you know, difficult to get hold of or becomes, you know, or just an outright inconvenience, you become, what can I say, you become complacent with the way things are, you know,
right.
until eventually something comes along and you just say, you know, something like another trip or another incident or some intense
sure.
emotional thing that drives you to, you know, to remember and say, yeah, you know, that's right, I remember. I'd like to do that again. I need to do that again. I need this new direction, you know.
Right.
And then once you have that direction, then you continue to follow it, and you realize that it's a wonderful way to go. And you forgot
right.
the way
what,
you forgot
what,
about it.
What
you know
some
what I mean?
People
are
say
you,
is they, you know, they think they need to be reminded again of who they fully are.
Right.
And either, you know, I know some people that say I'm going to take a psychedelic every year.
Oh.
And someone else says, you know, I'm going to go to Venice every year.
Right.
And someone
right.
else says, I need to go to Yosemite every year. We have different ways of reconnecting. But the word reconnect
so
is really the term.
That is true. And
it's really, for almost all of us, it's reconnecting with the natural world.
Oh,
you know, and
really?
There you are, even in the Abbey Studios, but how do you reconnect? Is you're an eagle in a forest and a lake?
That's right.
Sounds to me
that's
like
right.
reconnecting with nature. Even, you know, I've been in that part of London, and it's certainly not full of nature.
No, no, it's not. No, no. But it's the but no, and I didn't have it in the Abbey studio. This was in his in this guy's own studio. In fact, he lives in upstate New York. But but he you know, he created this unusual machine, and it really does what I just told you and more.
Wow.
But I have to say that I think I'm hoping that the world understands this, and people, especially people that are instead of raiding their mother's you know, pillbox there to for some for a quick high on some crazy prescription drug,
right,
might want to consider, you know, doing something natural.
Something that Mother Nature has made for you.
That's right. Instead of Merck Pharmaceutical or something, you know.
Well,
so,
I think, you know, the world is changing, and the politics are changing, and the laws, I think, are changing. And one of the things about, you know, putting out this book, because here I've, you know, I've done this research on and off for 40 years, and suddenly what I'm finding is, so far at least, no pushback. It's like,
really?
Nobody says to me, this is a terrible thing and you are destroying our youth.
Wow.
What people are saying to me is, and very, very, very straight people in very straight positions, what they're saying is, oh, yeah, you know, when I was in college. And then they tell me that they had experience and either they didn't make use of it or they did. But it seems to be okay in the culture. And the law is always slower than the people, but it looks like the people are, you know, the law and the people are starting to get in touch with each other.
But when you realize how many doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, teachers, and policemen smoke weed, you know, and probably pop an occasional tab of LSD, who knows?
Well,
but
what I found is that they very often remember that they did, and they almost always remember it with great pleasure.
That's very true. That's very
true. So it's unlikely that they're going to make legislation, you know, worse.
That's probably very true as well. I just wish they would make legislation better.
And also the research, you know, if we can help these guys, these veterans, with post-traumatic stress disorder, we're doing an incredible gift to the culture.
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing, too, is, you know, not just the vets, but, you know, those that are trapped in impossible places, you know, those people that are trapped in the ghettos and trapped in, you know, devastating economic conditions and stuff. And if they could just understand, you know, there's another way out.
Yep.
And I don't mean by drug addiction. I don't mean that, but there's a portal. There really is, and there's something there that will lead you to a greater place, to a better place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just have to, you know, believe that it's there. And
the mystics say is, you know, the kingdom of God is within.
Exactly,
and if taking a mushroom or smoking a joint or whatever
is going to get you,
you know,
to that higher
poverty.
Place. Do it, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, just do it, because it's crazy to be sitting there in pain, you know, pain and misery and no way out. But
right.
But do it properly, you know. Don't abuse it.
Fortunately, there are many different ways to end suffering, and any that we can use. And I certainly believe, as you do, you know, in education and nutrition and decent schools and not making wars. And these substances used correctly, they're just part of the mix to give us a better chance to survive
on the planet. To make it all work.
Yeah.
Oh, and we must not forget photography.
No, you and I will never forget photography.
We must never forget. No, photography is a wonderful therapy and could actually lead to a professional career. So just for those who might be out there wondering what they're going to do for careers. I don't know.
I got into photography because I come from a family where everybody was full of words and wrote books.
Yeah.
And I also was full of words.
Yeah.
And a friend who we'd walk around. It was Stuart Brand who did the Whole Earth Catalog and other things. And Stuart would say, look at that. And I'd look, and I wouldn't see anything. And
right.
I'd say, Stuart, what am I looking at? And he'd say, look at the way the shadow of that wire crosses that other shadow on the building side. And I'd look, and suddenly I'd see something interesting.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that I really wasn't seeing much, and Stuart was seeing a lot. And so the purpose of the camera at first was so I'd stop, and I'd look through the little hole, and I would try and see more. And as you said very kindly about some of my photographs, now and then I see something really wonderful, and I'm able to capture it.
Oh, you definitely got the right. You have a great eye. So I hope you continue that.
Well, I assure
hope,
you it is many, many, many photographs before the good ones.
Really, yeah. But those
are
great.
The nice thing is you never know when you go out with a camera whether this is
what
going to
get.
Be.
No, you don't. In fact, you could take 100 pictures and find 4 or 5 of them that are really nice. You know, wow, what
oh, you're,
there,
you're
you know?
Thrilled. It's been a perfect day.
Yeah, you know, so anyway. But, you know, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, James. I hope we can do this again.
Well,
and,
this was really fun.
And by the way,
and I'm really glad that I had the time and you had the inclination.
Yep.
And that
and by the way,
our mutual friend turned you on to me.
I'm sorry?
And that our mutual friend turned you on to me.
Yeah. I was just going to say that if you want... after the show is finished, if you need to, if you'd like to use it as an interview for your book, or, you know, you can embed it right on your blog if you'd like to.
Oh, absolutely.
You can download it right from the internet thing.
No, I want to put it up on my blog.
You're more than welcome to it. I'd be honored that you did. But the,
do you actually turn it into an MP3 file? And I'm maybe saying something
yep,
that
I just download it right there. Just download it from the show page. Just go to my website, my Blog Talk show page, and I'll give you that if you want to write it down. It's blog.
Wait, hold on a second. No, that I think I have that. That's
blogtalkradio.com.
Yeah, I think I just.
Yeah. /.
Yeah, because I think I just looked you up before.
Okay.
Yeah, but I have it.
/LASteelShow.org. All right.
That's it.
You go to that, and it'll bring you right to the show page.
This one is called 2011-923.
923 to the
LA Steel Show.
Right. And you'll see
that
because on it you'll be able to see the write-up that I had of you, James Fenneman, special guest.
Oh, good. Good,
okay.
Good. Yep.
Okay. And
all right. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, so please download it, and, you know, you can have them embed that right into your own blog and use it as a, you know, as a promotional tool. I'd be happy to.
We will make as good a use of you as we can.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Probably get arrested for it, but that's all right.
You know, what a nice thing to be arrested for.
I think telling people that they can have a more
beautiful life.
All right. Well, hey, good night, and bless you, and good luck to you, and hopefully I can talk to you in the future.
Thanks again.
All right, Bill.
Goodbye.
Yep. And that was James Fenneman, and I want to thank him for being on, and please join us tomorrow night when we have the great George Dixon joining us, and we will be... talking about the Mayan calendar and moving right along into that fourth dimensional state. So good night, everybody, and talk to you then.